Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Aging and death is a subject we still don't want to talk about, but with the number of Americans over the age of 85 doubling to 6 million, the nation's most rapidly growing age group, it's essential that parents speak with their adult children about their final wishes, or children need to ask their parents these essential questions about end-of-life decisions. Three-quarters of Americans want to die at home, but nearly half, 44%, die in hospitals. My guest today has written a personal memoir of her father's long decline, along with a medical inquiry about the issues surrounding aging, decline, and dementia. Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death details her father's life, his first stroke at 79, and the slow decline into dementia, and the toll it took on her mother, the primary caregiver. She also investigates the medical system for the aged, which she says has morphed from saving lives to extending death and dying. Katie Butler is my guest today. Her articles have appeared in The New Yorker, The Best American Science Writing, The Best American Essays. Her piece for The New York Times Magazine, What Broke My Father's Heart, won the Science and Society Award from the National Association of Science Writers and is the basis of the book Knocking on Heaven's Door. It's published by Scribner. She joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Katie Butler, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rich. I'm very pleased to be here.
Your new book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, is part personal memoir, it's family memoir, it's a medical history of your father, and it's also an investigative journalism piece. What led you to write about this personal experience of watching your father's decline and the decisions that were made that probably unnecessarily prolonged his life?
Well, I was a journalist before this whole process began, and when I was in my early 50s, my father was 79, and he had a devastating stroke on the other side of the country. And I immediately flew east and became very, very active in helping to take care of him. And I certainly didn't think of it as a story or something that I was ever going to write about. I just thought about it as this enormous blow that had hit my family's life that I was involved in. But then, a year after the stroke, my father was given a pacemaker very, very hastily with no real discussion of the long-term implications for our family. At that point, he was severely disabled. My mother was exhausted with caregiving. And he, frankly, really had outlived his happiness. So I really, as a journalist, as I watched my father continue to decline into dementia and near blindness and total misery over 6 years with this little device in his heart, keeping him going at a time when natural death would have been a blessing, because I was a journalist, I just couldn't rest until I came to understand what was going on with our medical system that such an important decision would be made in such haste with such little discussion. And so I ended up really having to understand the entire way we reimburse medicine, how doctors are trained, et cetera, what has led us to the point where so many people are having either very, very prolonged, painful declines that are actually longer than they want, and the fact that a fifth of us die in intensive care units plugged into machines, which is a kind of death that pretty much nobody I've ever run into has ever said they want.
Right.
So I just really had to understand, how do we get here?
Now, your father and mother were academics. They had a great life, and all the way through the 70s. It was really at the end of the 70s when you said you started noticing declines, and of course your father had a stroke. After the stroke, he recovered somewhat. He certainly had disabilities from the stroke, but he was able to resume a fraction of his former life. He was walking to the pool. So the doctor said he has this heart arrhythmia. Was any discussion about the stroke taken into account when the pacemaker was put in?
I think this is part of what makes these decisions so difficult, because people decline on a continuum. It's not like one day you say, this person has a wonderful quality of life, let's do everything we can, and then on day two, suddenly you say, this person has no quality of life, let's let nature take its course. It's not that. There's so many gray areas, and that was certainly the case here. A year after the stroke, my father was still really soldiering on, trying to get better, which he never did. And my mother still had hope that he would completely recover at some point, which was unfortunately a totally unrealistic hope because there are so many forces of decline in the body, so many ways. We age in 5,000 different ways our cells age. So it was an unrealistic hope. But what actually happened was that my father had developed a hernia from his water exercises at the pool. And to fix that, they wanted to put him under general anesthesia. And he needed a cardiology clearance. The cardiologist said, "You have a slow heartbeat. We're worried that something might happen during surgery. You need to get a pacemaker first." And so what was a really tiny decision, a hernia surgery, relatively minor decision, ended up leading to this pacemaker that had terrible long-term implications.
Although I think once you began doing a little research on statistics, you found that anytime you're around 80 years old or older and you're undergoing general anesthesia, the possible bad conclusions rise dramatically.
Exactly, because preserving the brain at that point becomes so much more important for most people than prolonging the life. And general anesthesia and even hip surgery and certainly open heart surgery all carry major, major risks of cognitive decline and dementia, and they're frankly not sufficiently discussed. It's unfortunate because we have this medical system where we have so many different experts for different parts of the body. So the cardiologist who is focusing on improving the heart is not an expert in the brain and won't even ask a question about, well, what's the mental status of this person? Or in my parents' case, how's the caregiver doing? Because caregiving, these late life diseases have more than one victim. You know, dementia has at least two victims, and one is the person with the dementia, and the other is the primary caregiver whose health suffers tremendously and whose quality of life declines.
And in this case, this was your mother.
Yes, who was just very, very painful to watch. She was a beautiful woman, elegant, and meticulous housekeeper. If anyone could have handled a situation like this, it was her, and it exhausted her and almost broke her over 6.5 years.
And really, within a year or so, she was really lamenting what was happening. I mean, it was, I want to think of it as that New England sort of stoic carry on. They're both New Englanders.
Yes.
At its heart, she was realized she wasn't able to do the job properly.
She had raised 3 children. She'd moved cultures twice, from South Africa to England to America. And she said this was the hardest thing that she had ever done. And there's a concept called ambiguous loss, which is when someone you love is there, but they're not there. And that's, of course, the experience of dementia. So here she was with a man she had loved for more than 50 years, watching him become incapable of putting his shoes on or knowing what a dinner napkin was or recognizing his children. And the pain of this, compounded with the absolute exhaustion of the kind of minute-by-minute caregiving that you have to do with someone when they're in that degree of dementia.
And that was even with help. She did have home health coming into the home.
We had an absolute angel named Tony who just saved our family's life. But you can't underestimate how difficult this is. And I guess one of the points of the book is, what are we doing this for? Are we worshiping at a altar of maximum longevity without really considering how we got here? What are the reasons for this? There are 28 million caregivers in my mother's situation in America, and I feel that they are under-recognized, culturally invisible, and not very well supported either socially or by the government. And it's a situation that is going to continue to blossom in our culture because people over 85 are the largest growing age group, and a third of them have dementia and half need help with some form of daily living.
Now, immediately after your father had the pacemaker installed, your mother and you both saw pretty strong cognitive declines.
You mean in the immediate aftermath
right.
of the pacemaker?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, in the immediate aftermath of the pacemaker, he suffered an immediate dip, which was undoubtedly the general anesthesia from the hernia surgery. And he sort of staggered up from that. Mm-hmm. I would say about a year after the pacemaker went in, the decline started to be quite obvious. And I remember him saying to me with great vehemence, "I am not going to get better." And he also said to my mother when I was not there, I'm living too long. He lost the, I think the most terrible thing that happened at that point was he lost the ability to turn his computer back on. Up until then, he'd been kind of laboring on a history of his life and on letters to me, and he could use the computer much better than he could write at that point because of all of his cognitive difficulties. And once he lost the ability to use the computer, it was pretty much a slow cascade down for about the next 5 years. And it was heartbreaking because this was a man I absolutely adored.
And it was a man who had overcome his own share of disabilities during his life. He lost an arm during World War II and overcame that, had a long career as a professor. And I imagine that just must have been the most frustrating thing for him.
I think so, because he really knew how to soldier on. I mean, he lost his arm when he was 21, and he really picked himself up, re-educated himself entirely. When I knew him as when I was growing up, he sailed a boat on Long Island Sound. He used to build bookcases in our basement, in his basement workshop. He really almost acted as though he hadn't lost an arm. So he really knew how to adapt to disability. But the stroke was really just too much for him. I remember him just saying, you know, this. Because he said to my mother one time, I don't know who I am anymore.
And the stroke did focus on some of his vocal abilities.
Yeah.
So he literally had to learn to speak again.
He had to learn to speak and find words. He became very, very difficult for him to finish a sentence. He really couldn't participate in a normal conversation. If you looked straight at him and you spoke in simple sentences, he could totally get what you were saying. And he could still read. He still read the New York Times every morning. But his ability to communicate rapidly with someone was just devastated. And this was a guy who he loved to argue. He loved to talk to you about what was in the paper and debate. He loved communicating with people. And when he was a teacher, he was a very, very respected and vital sort of showboat kind of a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I think it was devastating, which just raises this question, which I think is different for each of us, which is, what makes life living for us? And for him, I think at the point where he could no longer read the paper and he could no longer go down to the pool and exercise, there really wasn't a whole lot left for him. And I really remember the last 2 years of his life as really unmitigated, low-key misery. You know, it wasn't dramatic. It wasn't like he was suffering terrible physical pain and he was well taken care of. But knowing that he probably would have already experienced a natural death at that point. It was very, very, it just was very difficult to be with him and watch him go through this. Although, of course, I still had the opportunity to love him and to express my love for him and to care for him.
Yeah. My guest today is Katie Butler, a freelance journalist and the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. It's published by Scribner, which really, whether you have parents that are aging or whether you're aging yourself, this is a book you should read because it combines not only the personal history of her family, but it also goes into a lot of research. You talk to a lot of doctors, from the family doctor, who was really quite conservative in this sort of life prolongation thing that's going through modern medicine. He was, I don't think we should put a pacemaker in. I don't think we should take heroic efforts. He's 80 years old. The drawbacks and possible bad side effects outweigh probably the good side. And as your father declined and really sunk into dementia, your family basically said, let's disable this pacemaker, because the pacemaker, if it wasn't there, he would have probably died an earlier death, a natural death. Yeah. Doctors refused to do that.
Exactly.
I can understand why they wouldn't, because that does take a role in hastening death. But
It's interesting because there's so many things I want to say in response to just what you said. The first is just that I want this book to be something of a map for people so that when they're in this labyrinth of this last 5 years of life, they have at least some guideposts about the changes in the decisions that you make as time goes on. And so to get back to the pacemaker and the cardiologist, the cardiology associations have put together a consensus statement on the ethics. And the ethics are very clearly decided by the Supreme Court, which is that you have a right to request the withdrawal of any medical treatment You have no moral or legal obligation to undergo any medical treatment that you don't want. And that includes an internalized device like a pacemaker. So it's actually not considered euthanasia. It's not considered hastening death. It's considered allowing the underlying disease to take its natural course. And I think this is such a crucial distinction, and it's a line that I personally don't ever want to cross. So the doctors did refuse, and the doctor actually said, this cardiologist said, this would be like putting a pillow over your father's head. And unfortunately, that's what it felt like to him.
I think that's one of the key issues, is that you may have this ethical statement, but doctors have their own moral compass that exactly. are guiding them in their decision-making as well.
As it should. And it's very clear to me, I don't think any doctor should be required to do something that goes against their own moral values. But on the other hand, according to the law and the ethical standards of the profession, if a patient wants something that you're not ethically comfortable with, you actually have a moral obligation to refer the patient to another doctor who is in alignment with the patient's values and will, in fact, help that family or that patient.
Well, let's talk about one of the things you investigated as you began learning about your father's case, and that is the idea of slow medicine. And
yes.
slow medicine, I've heard it in terms of hospital stays. You know, now the fast medicine is we get you in, we cut you, we fix you, you go home real quick. Slow medicine in a hospital situation is the way hospitals used to be in the 30s or 40s. We nurse you back to health.
Yes.
How does slow medicine refer to end-of-life issues or decline?
In decline, slow medicine involves slowing down decision-making processes and allowing doctors to take more time with their patients. You mentioned our family doctor, Dr. Fales, who was the one who said, I don't want to see this man's life prolonged into a point where he has no reason for living. He could say that because he knew my family very, very well. He understood my parents' values, and frankly, he loved them. But we don't fund that kind of health care. We fund high-tech fixes that are very expensive. So the fast medicine approach is to throw a lot of tests or operations at a patient and hope that it produces better health. But when you're in decline, people in decline are kind of like Humpty Dumpty. They could be in their 80s or even their 90s, and they're still functioning quite well. But the systems on the inside are very, very fragile. And a hospital stay, for example, a minor surgery, a major surgery, all of these are things that can have very, very big downside risks as you get older. So slow medicine involves having a doctor who really knows you well enough to check out whether we've got to the point where less is more, I'm not just talking about not prolonging life. I'm also talking about quality of life while people are still alive. So that's kind of the essence of slow medicine, is let's pay our doctors better for their time and their wisdom and pay them less well for checking a lot of boxes on a form in a hurry and running a lot of tests that can be invasive and even dangerous for the very old.
I think this is one of the big issues of medical care for this century, the idea that our primary care physicians, the people that know us well, the best, are the least financially rewarded for that Exactly. relationship, which is something I think most people covet in their Absolutely. Interaction with medical care.
Exactly. An internist may make $150,000 a year, and a cardiologist or a gastroenterologist may make $450,000 or more. But especially as you get older, it's that family doctor who really knows you, who can really help. I want to give you one example from my father's case. Medicare paid $22,000 for the pacemaker and the hernia surgery, but they restricted my dad to $1,500 a year for speech therapy. Now, the speech therapy I would call much more of a slow medicine intervention. It takes a lot of time from the therapist to help you. It's very unglamorous. It's not, you know, nobody's going to win a prize for doing speech therapy. But in terms of the actual benefit to his life,
and quality of life.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Improvement in his quality of life. It gave him a reason for living. It was extremely significant and very under-rewarded.
One of the takeaways of your book is you say we have to rehumanize death. This is a taboo subject, really. Nobody wants to talk about these end of life. We don't want to talk about the decline. You know, when you look at our media, it's all about whether we're going to have enough money for the great retirement we see in the commercials where you're helming a yacht
exactly.
or you're, you know, living at the golf course, or and that is yeah. the popular culture imagery of old age. And yeah. certainly in your parents' case, they had that through a good part yes. of their 70s. But nobody talks about this decline into end of life. And yeah. nobody talks about how you navigate this process.
Exactly. It's like there's a young old age, which my parents experienced. And then there's old age, where people become extremely fragile and disabled over time. And I agree, we have no way of navigating this because we're in so much denial. I mean, there was an article about me in a local paper yesterday, and on the same page was an ad saying, live to be 100. And I personally, my personal theory is that we've gotten so good with dyeing our hair and doing Botox or whatever that we can look in the mirror and think, well, 60 is the new 40 or whatever it is, whereas 60 is really the new 59, you know. And I think we fool ourselves that we are going to continue to run marathons and then quietly die in our beds some night. That's not the usual course of death these days. It's usually a prolonged decline, and if you're not careful, it's bouncing in and out of the hospital repeatedly in the last year of life for fewer and fewer gains and more suffering.
Your family care doctor, who you mentioned a couple of times, this is another issue too, is that when you go to the emergency room or you go to the hospital, in the old days, you know, your family doctor was right there.
Yeah.
Nowadays, yeah. that's not necessarily the case. I don't know about the
rarely.
Particular. Yeah, I mean, rarely. Yeah. In fact, you're either a hospital doctor or you're of a private practice doctor, and those don't necessarily interlap the way they used to. Now, certainly there are exceptions to the rule, and certain hospitals will make exceptions. But to me, that's really important, is having that person who knows you the best in your corner.
Yeah. And it puts the doctors in a terrible position, because an aging person may show up in the emergency room. They could be 90 years old, and the doctor will not want to subject that person to CPR because they know the chances of true recovery are tiny, and they don't want to break the ribs of this ancient person or give them a shock in their last hours of life. But they don't know the family, and there's a worry of litigation. And if you've never even met someone before, and you are the person to sit down with them in a little waiting room or a broom closet and say, we would like to take your father off life support, or we would like to not put your father on life support, it's a devastating situation for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to go back to something that you raised a little earlier, which is we're not prepared for death the way we were in the old days. Mm-hmm. In the 1400s, a best-selling book was called Ars Moriendi, or The Art of Dying, and it was essentially a playbook to the deathbed. It was a how-to-do-it manual, and it had roles for everybody, what the dying person was supposed to say, what the people surrounding the dying person were supposed to say to reassure the dying person when they became afraid that they might go to hell, for example. So our culture had highly, highly developed ways of contemplating death before it occurred, and preparing oneself for it, and understanding the spiritual tasks of the end of life. There's a wonderful hospice doctor named Ira Byock, and he says the tasks of the end of life are, thank you, I love you, please forgive me, I forgive you, and goodbye. And the problem is, if we can't face that death is on its way, and we fight to the very last minute, and we do end up dying in intensive care, those final crucial conversations can't take place. And the medicalizing of death and the moving of it from the family house into this very complex institution where the family is not in charge and is sometimes shunted to the side has been an overwhelming change that we simply haven't gotten used to yet. In my case, I started writing my father thank you letters right after the stroke. The stroke was a gift to us in the sense that I knew at that point that my father was mortal and that I was going to lose him. And I started writing what I called legacy letters to him, where I thanked him specifically about various things he'd done in my childhood and in my later life that had supported me and allowed me to become who I was.
I would think that's some of your most treasured possessions, because he would respond.
Exactly. And I knew what it took, because at that point he was pecking things out on the computer, and it was very, very difficult for him. And so these letters have this compressed, poetic quality that I just deeply treasure.
This is a very important book, and I want to, just in a brief moment we have left, talk about your mother, because your mother was, she was the ultimate partner. I mean, she nursed your father through 6 years of decline, and it really helped perhaps destroy her health as well in doing that sort of nonstop stressful caregiving. But when her decline came on, she learned from her husband's experience.
She was a remarkable woman. I'm actually wearing two pieces of her jewelry right now, her earrings and a cross, Ethiopian cross that she loved. She learned a lot from what happened to my dad. She had two leaky heart valves. I took her to the best hospital in Boston, and the surgeon said, "What are you here for?" And she said, "To ask questions." And she did. And he actually said at one point, "Sit down, you're making me nervous." Quite something to make a surgeon nervous. And she really asked him about risks, and she was told about the risks of stroke and dementia. And she said to him, "If I have a stroke, I want you to let me go." And she was almost in tears. And he said, "I won't do that. That wouldn't be fair to my team. What if you just have a minor stroke? And if you fail, we will revive you and have you in intensive care." And after that meeting, she went off for one final test, and then she came back, and I was in the waiting room. She put on her coat, and she said, "I will not do it." And she was steadfast for the next 5 months. She had a lot of heart pain because she was dying. She cleaned the basement. She said she was not leaving a mess for her kids. She was that kind of woman. She apologized to me for certain things, for not having appreciated me enough and understood how much I loved her. And she told me who was to get her sewing machine. And then she had two heart attacks, one after another, a month apart. And she died very peacefully on a hospice unit in our local hospital. It was a tremendous example of courage and realism to me. She knew, the doctor told her, if you have the surgery, you might live to be 90. And if you don't, you have a 50-50 chance of dying within 2 years. And she was already 84 at that point. So she kind of weighed the odds, and she said, "I might get an extra 3 years out of this, but on the other hand, there may be 3 years in which I'm demented or damaged by a stroke, and I don't want to take that risk." I think it was an act of kindness to her children. It was an act of kindness to me, because I'd already gone through 8 years of caregiving with my dad and her at that point. And I think it was an act of kindness for herself, that she was a very decisive and independent woman, and she really wanted to die the death that she chose and not the death that her doctors had in mind.
Powerful book, Knocking on Heaven's Door. Katie Butler, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it a lot.
Writer Katie Butler's articles have appeared in The New Yorker, The Best American Science Writing, and The New York Times Magazine. Her new book is titled Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.